My name is Riley Barr. I'm interviewing Judge Alexander on May 25th, 2005 at the Washington County Courthouse. And here it is. How long have you lived in Hillsboro?
Oh, gosh, since 1975.
Describe your career and how it led to your position today.
Well, let's see, that's a little broader than just law enforcement. I started out as an assistant district attorney in Houston down in Texas after law school. And then I moved up here and was a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County, even though we lived out here, for about 4 more years. And then I had my own law firm in Beaverton for about 11 years, and then I went on the bench. So that's how I got to where I am.
If you think about how Hillsboro has changed over 25 years, what changes have had the biggest impact on crime and law enforcement?
You got a week? Basically what happens in any community is the growth. And we've had huge growth here. We've had a large percentage of people come in more than we ever thought. I was on the committee that planned the new jail, and we did some projections back then about how many people were going to live here in, you know, so many years into the future. And that was back in the 80s. So really, in the last 25 years, we thought that by about this time, we would have more than enough jail beds for the number of people that were living in the county. And we were completely wrong, because all the projections were way off in terms of how many people would be in jail. So the biggest change is not only the number of people that have moved in here unexpectedly, but also with the meth epidemic, the methamphetamine problems. The amount of crime we have now that lands people in jail is much higher than it was, or that we expected it to be. So I think we've all been a little surprised by the meth epidemic and the number of car thieves and identity theft and that kind of stuff that comes from the methamphetamine epidemic. So read me your question again. I'll try to focus a little more.
Oh, I got plenty. I said, okay. If you think Hillsboro has changed over 25 okay. years, what are the most?
Population, and it's the methamphetamine addiction that we're facing with all these people.
Why do you think meth has become such an important drug in their law enforcement?
Because it's cheap, and it's easy to make, and a lot of people are in the business of making it. You know, when I started out many years ago, the drugs we had to deal with were mainly heroin and cocaine and a little bit of marijuana. And that stuff, other than marijuana grows, it was hard to get heroin or cocaine. They had to bring it here from somewhere else, either the Far East or from South America. And there was a lot of smuggling and that kind of thing. Methamphetamine they can make in somebody's garage, you know, right here down the street. And it's fairly easy to distribute it, because there's so many small dealers all over the place. And apparently, of course, I don't know, I've never had to take the stuff, but I hear from the people that I get in court that it keeps them up all night for days at a time, and they feel just terrific when they have it, but then they crash really hard. They feel just terrible, and they haven't slept in 3 days, so you can imagine what that does to their body. But the thing is, while they're up for those days, they're not committing crimes like crazy. They have so much time on their hands, they have so much energy, they got to do something, so they're out there committing crimes.
So, would you agree that there's been an increase in drug trafficking since the 1980s?
Oh, yeah. Huge increase. Huge increase. Let me get my coffee just tiny. You can offer 10% of the drug. A lot more drug trafficking and methamphetamine is also because of the higher percentage of people we have from South America and Mexico now in this community. There's a lot more free flow of drugs across the border than there used to be. There's a lot of people bringing it in every day, you know, just in their cars and stuff.
What do you think, despite that change of population growth, why do you think people from Mexico and South America are coming to Hillsboro? Why not anywhere else in the country?
Well, there's jobs here. You know, they like to work in the kind of low-level jobs, the agriculture and a lot of them working in the businesses and stores doing labor-type work. Those people can make 10 or 100 times the amount of money they can make in their hometown. I mean, some of them come here and get what you and I might consider a minimum wage job, and they're supporting themselves and their family back in Mexico just on that money, because it's such a difference. So, yeah, I think it's just the opportunities here. And they have the other thing that happens to communities is once people live in a place from another area, other people from that area find out about it and they come to be with them because they've got somebody they know there, And it's not just the Hispanics that do that. People do that from the Midwest and from the East. You know, we have whole communities now of Russians and people like that that have moved in here because somebody got a foothold and then told everybody else about it. And we've even got a community of Texans here now, I'm sure. People that have moved from my home state because they heard about Oregon and came.
I'm from Canada myself, so.
Okay, same kind of deal. Yeah.
What do you believe is the biggest problem in Hillsborough law enforcement?
In law enforcement?
Yes.
Lack of jail space. We turn these people in and out. Do you have any, have you gotten any information on how the jail decides who stays in jail and who gets released?
No, we haven't. That's
you haven't talked to anybody about that? No. Okay. We have a certain number of jail beds.
Yeah.
The federal court has a limit on how many people you can put in a jail. So you can't double and triple bunk like we used to. So the federal judges have imposed orders on Washington County and they have to comply with those limits. And so that means when somebody comes in the front door from the police arresting somebody, somebody's got to go out the back door if they're full. And we're actually now up to the point where we're releasing over 100 people a week that wouldn't otherwise be released. We go through elaborate efforts to try and evaluate who should be released. And anybody that's even a halfway decent risk to be released pending a trial gets released. They sign a release agreement or they post a small amount of bail or somebody else signs third party form. All those people have already been released. It's the ones that are left in the jail that shouldn't be released. Then we're cutting out another chunk of about 100 or more per week of those people that shouldn't be released. We're back on the street, and they're right back committing crimes. So it's like this big vicious circle, you know. It's literally a revolving door that some of these guys get arrested four or five times on property crimes before they finally get held long enough for us to get them to court and get them tried.
How do you feel that impacts public safety?
Oh, it's a huge difference. You know, if you have a credit card, be sure you're very careful with the number. You can't leave anything in your car now without the risk that somebody will break in just to get small amounts of money or things on the seat, you know, anything that they can steal. We're having an increase in occupied dwelling burglaries where people are actually at home and some burglar breaks in. They've gotten very brazen about it. You know, they've started doing whatever they need to get money. And we didn't used to see that in Hillsborough. That's a big difference.
Yeah. Do you believe there's adequate funding? You touched on it earlier that the jails had not enough beds. Do you believe there's adequate funding in the Hillsborough law?
No, there's never enough money. And here we do a better job than some places. The people did vote for that new jail, which was good. We built a $95 million jail. But unfortunately, there's not enough money in the operating budget to staff it all the time. Multnomah County has a jail that's entirely empty. They have a whole new building, brand new jail, and it's not operating because they can't staff it. They don't have the money in their ongoing operations budget to staff it. So a lot of those people in Multnomah County that ought to be in jail are not, so they're coming out here committing crimes. So it's not just here in Washington County. The whole Tri-County area is not funding the jails properly. They do a pretty good job of financing the police. There are a lot of police officers on the street. But they're not doing anything about the jail part of it.
In what areas in law enforcement has the law enforcement improved since the 1980s?
Their use of non-lethal force is a big change. You know, we have tasers now and they use pepper spray and we have different kinds of ways to subdue people without causing them serious injury or death. That's one huge change. It used to be if anybody pulled a weapon on a police officer, they just got killed. I mean, that just happened over and over again. Now the officers try very hard not to use lethal force unless they have to. We have real improvements in the scientific evidence that the police are able to gather. I mean, CSI is kind of a phony show, but there's a lot of truth to it. There are a lot of improvements in the technology that we use. The police are much better at that. And I think the officers are more educated. The vast majority of our police officers have some college now, if not a college degree, and the quality of the people we're getting in the police, I think, is much better.
I'm going to jump to another topic here.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe your role in prosecuting criminals?
My role now or when I was a prosecutor?
Right now.
Okay.
And before. Describe how that changes. Like, back in the 1980s, you were district attorney. Now you're how does that change?
Well, of course, the biggest difference is when you're an attorney for either side. I was also a defense attorney for 11 years. An attorney for either side is obligated to represent that side of the dispute and to be an advocate for that side, usually. And so you don't have any discretion really, other than what you're going to charge and so forth as a DA. You just present your case, and the judge does it. As a judge, you're not on anybody's side. You're neutral, and so you're only making the determinations about guilt or innocence if you're asked to, and accepting pleas of guilty, and then you're deciding what sentences are going to be. So, a judge doesn't prosecute people. That's not the correct term. But a judge sentences people. And I think that my role is to, you know, get as many people into programs and into things that will rehabilitate them as possible. And the ones that can't be rehabilitated need to be locked up. And I do that a lot. And I send a lot of people to prison because they just can't make it in the community.
Have any recent or past measures or laws hinder that ability?
Oh, yes. Measure 11 is our biggest problem. Have you heard that term? Measure 11 is the mandatory minimum sentencing law. If I get my guide, oh, here it is. This is the gridlock that we do. Anybody that's sentenced on a felony comes in and they land somewhere in this grid. On this side is the seriousness of the crime, goes from the least serious level 1 all the way up to level 11. And then over here is their prior record. So if they have no prior record, they're way out here on the right side of the grid, and as they accumulate convictions for different things, they move this way. So what you do is you get the crime seriousness, and you come over to their prior record, and it tells you what the presumptive sentence is.
Okay.
Everybody above the line in the yellow goes to prison. Everybody below the line in these other colors gets some kind of local community probation or supervision. And Measure 11 knocks all that out. All this elaborate structure that we have is just worthless as to Measure 11, because all of these crimes which are under Measure 11, there's a whole list of them here, there's a mandatory sentence that the judge has no discretion, you have to impose regardless of what this says. So even though someone might get probation because it's their first offense on some of these things, instead they get a mandatory 70 or 75 month prison term. So, and there's other statutes like that now for repeat property offenders, people who steal multiple cars, that kind of thing. The legislature has started setting mandatory sentences of 13 months or 19 months or whatever, you know, for people depending on their prior history. So they take the discretion completely away from the judge. You have to impose that sentence. You have no choice.
So how does that make you feel? Does it believe it takes away your freedom more as a judge?
That's ridiculous. It should never happen. Measure 11 is one of the worst laws that's ever passed. The judges are there to exercise discretion, and that's the point. I mean, that's my job, is to make those decisions. And you know, before Measure 11, if I got somebody that committed a rape in the first degree or an armed robbery, I sent them to prison for a long time anyway. You don't have to tell me that, but the occasional rare case where that's not the right sentence, a judge should have the ability to do something different, and you don't under these mandatory sentencing laws. That's terrible laws.
Describe the effectiveness of the Patriot Act on criminal prosecution in Huntsville.
I don't think the Patriot Act had anything to do with it, because it's a federal law, and I don't think our local law enforcement people have relied on it very much. I signed a lot of the search warrants, and I've seen very few references to that. That may be doing something on the federal side, the FBI or the DEA, some of those agencies that are federal, may be using it out here, but if they are, they don't come to my court, they go to federal court, so I wouldn't see that.
So you would agree it's more on a federal level than impacting
state? Yeah, we'd never see it on a state local level.
Do you feel it should be renewed?
The Patriot Act? You know, that's more a political question. I'm not going to answer that one, just because judges don't express opinions on political things, and I think that's entirely up to the federal people that can deal with that.
If you could change or create your own law that would help limit violence, what would it be?
Limit violence. I would much more... how to say this? I would try to structure a way that we could take the guns away from people.
Okay.
Right now, there are too many people that have guns. They have too much opportunity to use the guns. They have too much opportunity to have people steal guns in burglaries, and then the criminals use the guns against them. You know, there are a lot of law-abiding citizens who have guns, but they don't take care of them, and they end up in the hands of the wrong people. So I would try and do something to be more like Britain or some of the other civilized nations, Canada. You can't have handguns in Canada, and that would help this community a lot if we could reduce the number of firearms that people just have.
So you believe that gun control would help limit violence in the community?
I guarantee you, but and the National Rifle Association will never permit it. They'll block it at every step of the way when we try to legislate, but There's no question but that just the huge number of guns is causing problems in this country that other countries don't have.
So, I'm going to jump into my topic here,
okay,
too. How have the courts addressed gang-related issues over the past 25 years?
We try very hard not to hold that against people that they happen to be in a gang. We don't discriminate against somebody because they're in a gang. Now, I did rule on one case that went all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court, where I ruled that because a police officer knew about a certain 18th Street gang and that they often carried weapons, that gave the officer probable cause to search some 18th Streeters that were hanging out, and sure enough, they all had guns on. And that went all the Supreme Court and was upheld, but we try really hard not to make a distinction on the gangs because it shouldn't be against the law to associate with other people. It should be against the law to commit crimes. So we don't discriminate because they're in gangs.
How serious have gangs become?
I don't think they're any more serious now than they've ever been. I think there's more of them with more names, but I don't see a lot of gangs committing any more crimes than they used to.
Do you believe the media has influenced gang involvement?
Maybe to some extent they tend to glamorize it a little bit, and they probably shouldn't, but really, we don't have a big gang issue in this community, not like some places I've been. You know, there's no biker gangs in Brooklyn. You know, the Hispanic gangs are not all that dangerous. I mean, it's really a pretty low-key gang community.
Have gangs grown larger in the past 25 years?
No, I think we just have more people here, so you're going to have more people in gangs. Just the population increase. I don't think the percentage of people in gangs is any bigger.
Why is that so? Why do you believe?
Well, the gangs fill a need. They fill a place for people who don't have a strong family, who don't have a strong group at school, you know, they don't belong to anything. So the gang's there. It's sort of their family. And if there's always, you know, as long as we're going to have dysfunctional families in the community, we're going to have gangs because they're going to step in and be the family.
Okay. Describe the ethnicity and gang participation and the changes in involvement since the 1980s.
Probably in the 80s, we have mainly had the Hispanic gangs. We might have had an Asian gang, but that's pretty much it. Now we have gangs of every type. You know, every group sort of forms their own gang. The Russians have one, the Asians, the Thais have one. You know, it just spreads through the whole community. But again, it's just people grouping. It's not anything all that serious, frankly.
What changes in law enforcement need to limit these occurrences, crime of gangs?
Well, we have a gang enforcement unit in almost every agency, and they mainly provide intelligence, and it's worthwhile because a lot of times the gang kids will work with you to solve crimes. They don't like the people commit the crimes either. So I don't think, you know, as long as the law enforcement finances a special unit to work with the gangs, I think that's all they really need to do.
Okay. Also, go back to the drug topic.
Mm-hmm.
So, what type of drugs have been the most prevalent? You touched on meth earlier.
Right.
Do you agree that that's... How has the drugs since the 1980s changed? Like, people using cocaine, now they're using meth.
Yeah, that's the biggest change. I think the large numbers of people have shifted from cocaine and heroin to using methamphetamine. I see very few heroin addicts now. I used to see them fairly often. Now it's mostly methamphetamine. I think there's been a large increase in the marijuana, also because we've legalized it for some people. So now there's a lot of marijuana grows that didn't exist before, and those people end up selling, you know, illegally. And so there's a bigger problem with marijuana. But marijuana doesn't have the same kind of negative effects on the community that the stronger drugs do, okay. So it's not a big issue.
Do you see a trend in ethnic groups and drug association? Has this really changed since 1980?
No, if anything, I think the methamphetamine cuts across everybody. I mean, we see everybody on meth. Doesn't matter what their ethnic background is. So I think it's less, it's more of a blurred line now than it was in the 80s.
Okay. Has the law enforcement in Hillsborough done an adequate job in prosecuting drug cases?
Oh, yeah. I think they spend a lot of time and resources on drugs, probably as much as, I mean, and it doesn't do them much good to arrest the people and prosecute them if you can't lock them up. So what's the point? You know, we have one in-house treatment program in our jail, very limited bed space, and once we get past that number of people, nobody else can get either in the jail or outside of the jail treatment. So it's, law enforcement's doing everything they can.
Okay. Have age groups using drugs lowered since 1980? Have drugs become more acceptable?
I wouldn't say more acceptable. I think it's lowered only because I think young people are more sophisticated now than they were in 1980. It's just a matter of, the society is just bombarded kids with so much stuff now they didn't used to see when they were that age. And so, it's just a natural evolution kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I think that pretty much wraps it up.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your time.
Sure. Hope you can get some of that into a paper.
Thank you.
It's a lot of material.
And I'd also like to invite you to the presentation of this project at Century High School.
Oh, yeah?
We hope you can come. It's on June 15th. And we're doing a whole presentation there. We've got good speaking. We're actually making an entire booklet.
Okay.
So
what's the 15th of June? Is that what day of the week? It's Wednesday?
Is
it going to be during the day?
It's Wednesday, yes.
Okay.